Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson, and I'm genuinely thrilled to be your guide today as we plunge into a truly remarkable and, frankly, intense period in the U.S. federal government. We're calling this particular deep dive the Federal News Update for Monday, August 18th, 2025.
And I'm Sam Kennedy, ready to help navigate the intricate layers of policy, power, and perception that unfolded over these pivotal 72 hours.
That's right. We're focusing on a critical 72-hour window spanning from Friday, August 16th, right through to Monday, August 18th, 2025. This wasn't some quiet summer weekend in Washington, quite the opposite. It was a moment of intense and deeply consequential activity for the United States federal government. What makes it even more fascinating, almost like a strategic chess match, is how the executive branch seized this opportunity, operating with maximal latitude, highly assertively, precisely because both the legislative and judicial branches were in their customary August recess. This institutional calm, or perhaps legislative silence, allowed the White House and administrative agencies to aggressively reshape critical contours of both American foreign and domestic policy.
Indeed. This brief but impactful period was characterized by two powerful parallel thrusts of executive action. On the global stage, we witnessed a rapid diplomatic campaign launched immediately after a high-stakes presidential summit. This campaign aimed to fundamentally alter the trajectory of the Russo-Ukrainian war and, crucially, redefine the U.S. role within the transatlantic alliance.
And at the same time.
Concurrently, right here at home, there was a series of profound domestic regulatory transformations. These were initiated through the formal administrative process, aimed at advancing a distinct and often ideologically charged agenda.
Right.
This deep dive will provide you with an exhaustive, multidisciplinary analysis of each significant federal action and its far-reaching implications. We'll be detailing the sophisticated strategic communications blitz that was designed to manage international fallout, the anxious, sometimes frustrated responses from key allies.
Uh-huh.
The predictable yet deeply revealing domestic political fractures, and the major proposed regulations that will reshape sectors of American life.
Yeah, and what's clear is that this brief window was one of deliberate and rapid policy execution, leveraging the institutional calm of a Washington summer to advance a truly transformative and, let's be honest, controversial agenda.
Absolutely. These actions have already set the stage for critical negotiations and potentially fierce legal and political battles whose outcomes will reverberate through the U.S. and globally for a long time to come.
I'm genuinely eager to unpack all these crucial developments, understanding not just what happened, but the deeper implications for how our government actually functions and what it means for everyone listening. So let's get right into it, starting with the global stage and the immediate aftermath of that summit. Our journey into this intense 72-hour period really begins with the lingering ripples from the August 15th, 2025 summit between President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin in Alaska. The summit itself, by most accounts, had ended inconclusively. Many observers, particularly those in Europe and Kyiv, had been holding their breath, hoping for an immediate ceasefire in Ukraine.
Right, that was the big hope.
When no such agreement emerged, it could easily have been perceived as a significant diplomatic setback, even a failure to achieve a primary goal. But what followed was not quiet reflection or a period of assessing losses. It was an immediate, almost surgical strike in the information war.
Absolutely. The administration's response was a meticulously executed media blitz that commenced almost immediately, reaching a crescendo on Sunday, August 17th. Spearheading this effort was Secretary of State Marco Rubio, a seasoned political communicator. He made a concerted round of appearances on all the major Sunday political talk shows. We saw him on NBC's Meet the Press, CBS's Face the Nation, and Fox Business's Sunday Morning Futures.
Hitting all the big ones.
Exactly. His mission was crystal clear and highly coordinated. Articulate a new, unified White House narrative that sought to fundamentally reframe what some had perceived as a diplomatic void into a strategic repositioning. This wasn't just spin. It was an attempt to fundamentally reset expectations and shape international perception.
And central to this narrative was a significant and, well, strategic pivot in U.S. policy regarding the war in Ukraine. Prior to the Alaska meeting, the administration had consistently and very clearly communicated to its European allies and the American public that securing a ceasefire was the immediate primary objective of this summit.
That was the messaging, yeah.
We know, for instance, that both French President Emmanuel Macron and German Chancellor Friedrich Merz had publicly stated that President Trump had personally assured them this would be his top priority in Alaska. So when the summit concluded on August 15th without such an agreement, that was a huge moment of cognitive dissonance for many.
A real head-scratcher.
But the messaging that poured out on August 16th and 17th aggressively countered this perception of a shortfall. President Trump himself, with his characteristic directness, posted on social media that it was determined by all that the best way to end the horrific war is to go directly to a peace agreement, and not a mere ceasefire agreement.
Quite the statement.
And Secretary Rubio, in his multiple interviews, echoed this line precisely, almost verbatim. He argued that while a ceasefire was not off the table, implying it wasn't rejected.
Right, keeping it technically alive.
Right. The ultimate goal had always been a full peace deal to end the war permanently. This rhetorical shift retroactively reframed the lack of an immediate ceasefire, not as a failure, but as a conscious, more ambitious decision to pursue a comprehensive outcome.
And crucially, the strategic realignment brought the U.S. negotiating posture significantly closer to Russia's longstanding preference for a comprehensive settlement on its own terms, rather than an incremental pause.
That's a key point. It really shifted the ground.
And that alignment extended deeply into the very lexicon of diplomacy, with the normalization of concepts previously central to the Kremlin's own diplomatic vocabulary. Secretary Rubio repeatedly acknowledged Vladimir Putin's stated desire to address the root causes of the conflict.
Which is Russia's framing, essentially.
Exactly. It's a phrase Putin has used consistently for years to refer to his grievances regarding NATO expansion eastward and Ukraine's growing alignment with the West, effectively placing a narrative of Western provocation alongside Russian aggression. This adoption of Russian terminology was then consistently coupled with a persistent new emphasis on the absolute necessity of mutual concessions.
Ah, the both sides argument.
Precisely. In almost every interview, Rubio stressed that for any deal to be reached, both sides are going to have to give up something, and that neither Ukraine nor Russia could expect to get everything it wanted. This language, implicitly but powerfully, signaled a departure from the previous Western stance that Russia, as the aggressor, must make the primary concessions.
Right.
Instead, it subtly prepared the diplomatic ground for the expectation of significant Ukrainian compromises, potentially even on territorial integrity or its sovereign right to choose its alliances. It was a carefully constructed verbal framework designed to prepare international audiences for difficult decisions ahead for Kyiv.
But the administration also tried to make such difficult concessions more palatable for Kyiv and its European allies by simultaneously elevating the concept of what they called NATO-like security guarantees for Ukraine. This was designed to offer a potential sweetener, you know, for the bitter pill of territorial or sovereignty concessions.
A potential trade-off.
Exactly. Special Envoy Steve Witkoff, for instance, described the agreement on these guarantees as game-changing, even going so far as to suggest that Russia had agreed to Article 5-like protections for Ukraine. For context, Article 5 is the cornerstone of NATO, a collective defense clause where an attack on one member is considered an attack on all.
Huge implications, if true.
Huge. Secretary Rubio presented this as a potentially massive U.S. commitment that would finally provide Ukraine with the long-term security it has desperately sought. The implied promise here was that such robust security guarantees coming from the U.S. would create significant political space for Kyiv to consider concessions on other fronts, like territorial boundaries or a more neutral status.
So they were constructing a new, complex negotiating framework. In exchange for what was presented as a historic U.S. security commitment, Ukraine would be expected to engage in talks about the root causes of the war and potentially make painful sovereign concessions. It was a trade-off, as framed by Washington.
Yeah, a quid pro quo, essentially.
In essence, this entire narrative, which was constructed and disseminated with remarkable speed and precision within just 48 hours of the summit's conclusion, was far more than a simple report on the meeting's events. It was a highly sophisticated and rapid strategic pivot, meticulously designed to manage public perception both domestically and internationally.
Mm-hmm.
More critically, it was engineered to fundamentally alter the underlying negotiating landscape, creating space for and implicitly accommodating Russian demands while placing immense unprecedented pressure on Ukraine. It was, arguably, a masterclass in strategic communication and diplomatic reorientation.
Wow. Okay, so that sets the stage. Let's talk about how the rest of the world reacted. Hashtag TAC 1.2 International Reverberations and Alliance Management. As you can well imagine, this abrupt policy shift from Washington sent immediate shockwaves reverberating through Kyiv and across European capitals. It wasn't just a change in talking points.
No, far from it.
It triggered a weekend of intense, high-stakes diplomatic activity aimed at assessing the full scope of the damage and, more urgently, recalibrating their own strategies in response. The reactions from U.S. allies were a delicate, often contradictory blend of public deference to Washington and deeply felt private alarm, culminating in a coordinated effort to reassert their influence over a process they increasingly feared was slipping from their control.
For Ukraine, the Alaska summit and its immediate aftermath were a source of profound anxiety, even indignation. The optics of the event were particularly stinging.
I can only imagine.
The red carpet treatment afforded to Putin on U.S. soil, complete with a military flyover, or presidential motorcade, and the pomp of a head of state reception. Many in Kyiv saw this as a painful legitimation of a leader under an international criminal court arrest warrant for war crimes, a global pariah seemingly welcomed back to the world stage by America.
Yeah, that visual must have been incredibly difficult.
Ukrainian analysts and officials widely concluded that Putin had successfully used Trump to break his diplomatic isolation and had decisively won the informational war without offering any tangible concessions in return. This pervasive frustration, however, was quickly tempered by a stark and undeniable pragmatism.
Had to be.
Recognizing the new, uncomfortable reality of American policy, President Volodymyr Zelensky engaged in what his office termed a long and substantive phone call with President Trump on August 16th. He accepted the invitation for a high-stakes in-person meeting in Washington on August 18th, understanding, perhaps painfully, that direct engagement, even under these terms, was now his only viable path to influence the process, secure Ukraine's interests.
So, go into the lion's den, basically.
Essentially. In his public statements during this period, Zelensky skillfully navigated the treacherous diplomatic terrain. He carefully avoided any direct contradiction to President Trump, a necessity given Ukraine's dependence on U.S. aid.
Can't bite the hand that feeds you.
While simultaneously, subtly but firmly, reasserting Ukraine's non-negotiable red lines, particularly the constitutional prohibition against ceding sovereign territory by force, it was an immensely difficult, delicate balancing act. How to maintain the vital support of its most powerful benefactor while simultaneously resisting that same benefactor's push for a peace settlement on terms Ukraine viewed as fundamentally unacceptable and an existential threat.
Meanwhile, European leaders, who had felt entirely blindsided by the abrupt pivot away from their previously agreed-upon ceasefire-first strategy, responded with a coordinated campaign of what can best be described as damage control and strategic re-engagement.
They were not happy.
Definitely not. They had just days before the summit, in a virtual meeting, been assured of a common approach with Washington. Now they found themselves marginalized, watching as the core principle of nothing about Ukraine without Ukraine appeared to have been visibly violated in Anchorage. Their immediate response on August 16th and 17th was not one of open defiance, which would have risked a complete rupture with a volatile Trump administration that prizes loyalty.
Smart politics, maybe.
Instead, it was a far more subtle and sophisticated exercise in soft power and alliance management. Publicly, they issued a joint statement signed by leaders from France, Germany, the United Kingdom, and the European Commission that carefully welcomed President Trump's efforts to avoid antagonizing him. Observers in Brussels and Paris described this tactic as a calculated charm offensive, a pragmatic recognition of the undeniable necessity of working with the current U.S. administration, regardless of their private misgivings.
And this pragmatic recognition quickly translated into concrete coordinated steps designed to reinsert themselves into the diplomatic process and crucially create a more unified front. The joint statement, while publicly deferential, also contained firm demands. It insisted on a future trilateral summit format that must involve President Zelensky ensuring Ukraine's direct participation.
Trying to get back in the room.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It also reaffirmed that comprehensive sanctions pressure on Moscow would be maintained, pushing back against any notion of sanctions relief without clear Russian concessions. Furthermore, France, the UK, and Germany, often seen as the engine of European foreign policy, organized a prompt coalition of the willing video call on Sunday, August 17th.
Getting your ducks in a row.
Pretty much. This was a clear and deliberate move to coordinate their collective positions, solidify their resolve, and strategically bolster President Zelensky's negotiating hand just before his critical Washington visit. This dual-strategy public accommodation of President Trump, combined with collective, private action to constrain his options and shore up support for Ukraine, vividly revealed a European alliance grappling with how to manage a uniquely unilateralist American partner while simultaneously trying to salvage the core tenets of their own security policy and protect a sovereign European state from external pressure.
A very tricky balancing act for them, too. And what was Russia's take on all of this? How did they frame the outcome of the summit and the subsequent U.S. policy shift?
Officially, Moscow described the talks with President Trump as very frank, constructive, and productive. Kind of standard diplomatic language, but they were quick to praise what they termed Trump's sincere efforts to end the war, a stark contrast to their usual criticisms of Western leaders.
Interesting praise, given the circumstances.
Right. State media, as you might expect, framed Putin's reception in Alaska as nothing short of a triumphant return to the global stage, emphasizing him being treated as a co-equal superpower by the United States. This narrative was carefully crafted to project an image of Russia breaking out of isolation and dictating terms, further amplifying the pressure on Kyiv and sowing discord within the Western alliance.
Playing the information game very effectively, it sounds like.
It seems that way. Hashtag tag 1.3 domestic political fracture and expert analysis. The Alaska summit and its immediate aftermath, well, they didn't just send ripples internationally. They immediately became a potent flashpoint in American domestic politics. The events exposed a deep and, frankly, often unbridgeable chasm in how the nation's relationship with Russia and its role in the world are perceived within the U.S. The reaction in Washington predictably split cleanly and vociferously along partisan lines.
No surprise there, really. So on one side, Republican lawmakers quickly rallied to defend the president's actions, framing the summit through a lens of assertive leadership and shrewd deal-making. For example, Representative Brian Mast of Florida interpreted the ceremonial B-2 bomber flyover at the summit not as a welcoming gesture, but as a calculated signal of American military power, meant to remind Putin of the very serious consequences of non-cooperation.
An interesting interpretation of a flyover.
Indeed. Other Republicans, like Representative Andy Ogles of Tennessee, went even further, publicly announcing their intention to nominate President Trump for the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts to end the conflict. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, often a bellwether for mainstream Republican thought, expressed cautious optimism, suggesting the summit could lead to a peace deal well before Christmas, provided a trilateral meeting involving Ukraine followed.
So the Republican narrative really focused on the optics, the deal-making itself as the win.
Exactly. This narrative meticulously focused on the optics of the engagement and the president's personal deal-making prowess, casting the very act of meeting and the subsequent policy shift as a diplomatic victory in itself, proof of a strong leader taking decisive action.
Democrats, naturally, offered a diametrically opposed interpretation, tinged with outrage and accusations of capitulation. Representative Eric Swalwell of California, known for his blunt commentary, described the event as President Trump toasting Putin like he was giving him the Lifetime Achievement Award, going so far as to call the president a Kremlin kiss-a-butt.
Wow, strong words.
Very strong. Senator Gene Shaheen of New Hampshire, a senior member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee and a vocal critic of Russia, declared that the president appears to have been played yet again by Vladimir Putin and called for Congress to immediately pass crushing sanctions in response to the lack of a concrete outcome for Ukraine. The Democratic Party's official social media account, in a stark and unvarnished post, stated, "Trump invited a dictator onto U.S. soil just to get his rocked."
Okay, so clearly no ambiguity there.
None whatsoever. This reaction centered on the moral and ideological impropriety of engaging with an autocratic leader accused of war crimes and the perceived failure to impose punitive measures against Russia, portraying the president as naive or even compromised.
What's truly fascinating here, and quite sobering, is the stark contrast between this highly partisan domestic debate and the remarkable consensus that simultaneously emerged among nonpartisan foreign policy experts and seasoned diplomats.
Precisely. There was a striking and unusual consensus across a range of leading nonpartisan think tanks and policy institutions, including the Atlantic Council, the Brookings Institution, the Center for a New American Security, and the British Chatham House. Their collective analysis was unambiguous. The summit was a clear strategic victory for Vladimir Putin.
A consensus view, really.
Pretty much. Across the board from these established institutions. Experts from these institutions, many of whom have decades of experience in U.S.-Russia relations, including former Trump administration officials like Fiona Hill, argued compellingly that Putin achieved his primary objectives without offering any meaningful concessions. He successfully broke out of the diplomatic isolation that the West had diligently built since the 2022 invasion. He reclaimed his status as a co-equal on the world stage, a legitimacy reinforced by the pomp and ceremony of a presidential reception on American soil.
So the optics that Republicans saw as strength, the experts saw as legitimizing Putin.
That's the core of the expert analysis. Furthermore, these seasoned analysts consistently concluded that President Trump was strategically outmaneuvered. His abrupt reversal on the ceasefire demand was seen not as a strategic pivot, but as clear evidence that he had run up against a rock in the form of Putin, facing an immovable object and being forced to adjust his own position.
So less a choice, more a reaction.
That's how they framed it. Analysts pointed to a fundamental asymmetry in the negotiations. Putin, described as a steely, detail-oriented dictator, possesses a deep command of historical facts, geopolitical context, and specific negotiating points. In contrast, President Trump's grasp of the issues is often described as less secure, relying more on personal rapport and broad strokes, making it exceedingly difficult for him to secure a favorable deal against such a prepared adversary.
An experience mismatch, maybe?
Perhaps. The most damaging outcome, in this expert view, was the successful transfer of diplomatic pressure from Moscow squarely onto Kyiv. By adopting Russia's framing that Ukraine must make concessions and emphasizing the need for a full peace deal, the administration effectively shifted the onus for ending the war onto President Zelensky, who is now expected to get it done, a formidable, if not impossible, task under these new terms.
Wow. So this profound disconnect between the partisan political framing and the expert strategic analysis highlights a deeply troubling challenge of conducting complex international diplomacy within a hyper-polarized American political environment.
Absolutely.
Where assessments of national interest are often subordinated to the immediate demands of domestic political messaging and electoral advantage.
It makes consistent strategic foreign policy incredibly difficult.
Right. So while the diplomatic world was consumed by the implications of the Alaska summit and the subsequent shift in U.S. foreign policy, the executive branch was simultaneously advancing a powerful domestic agenda, meticulously leveraging the machinery of the administrative state. On August 18th, 2025, the Daily Federal Register, that seemingly mundane compendium of government activity, revealed two highly consequential executive actions. These weren't about international relations. They were about reshaping policy right here at home, affecting millions of Americans and the operational landscape of numerous organizations.
Okay, so on August 18th, the Department of Education published a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, or NPRM, in the Federal Register. This rule specifically concerns the William D. Ford Federal Direct Loan Program, and within that, focuses on a critical, often life-changing benefit, the Public Service Loan Forgiveness, or PSLF, program.
PSLF, yeah, a lot of people rely on that.
Exactly. As a quick background, the PSLF program was originally established by Congress back in 2007. Its fundamental purpose was noble: to encourage graduates to enter vital but often lower-paying public service careers by offering the cancellation of the remaining federal student loan debt after 10 years of qualifying payments while working for eligible employers.
A pretty straightforward incentive, you'd think.
You would. This proposed rule, however, seeks to introduce a significant and, as we'll see, highly controversial new layer of eligibility criteria. It represents a subtle but profound redefinition of what public service actually entails in the eyes of the government.
And this is where it gets really interesting and, frankly, quite contentious. The core of this proposal is a provision that would disqualify entire employers from the PSLF program if the Secretary of Education unilaterally determines they are engaged in activities with a substantial illegal purpose.
Substantial illegal purpose. That sounds broad.
It is. Now, while the stated goal on the surface is to protect taxpayer funds from subsidizing organizations engaged in unlawful conduct, the specific definitions of substantial illegal purpose outlined in the NPRM are remarkably expansive and critically target activities squarely at the center of contemporary political and cultural debates.
Okay, like what?
Let's look at some explicit examples. The proposed rule explicitly lists providing gender-affirming care to minors in states where such care is legally restricted. The proposal adopts highly charged, non-medical language from a prior executive order, labeling these treatments as chemical and surgical castration or mutilation. That language is not neutral.
Definitely not neutral medical terminology.
Right. What this could mean, in practical terms, is that public hospitals, university medical centers, and clinics in nearly half the country, which often provide such care, could see their employees disqualified from PSLF, impacting nurses, doctors, and support staff.
Wow. So impacting potentially thousands of healthcare workers.
Potentially. Another example is aiding or abetting violations of federal immigration laws. This is incredibly broad language that could be interpreted to apply to a wide range of legal aid societies, nonprofits, and social service organizations that provide humanitarian or legal assistance to undocumented immigrants.
So even providing basic aid could fall under this.
Imagine a shelter providing food and temporary housing, or a legal aid clinic offering advice on asylum claims. Under a broad interpretation, their very mission could be deemed an illegal purpose by the secretary. And then there's the provision for engaging in a pattern of aiding and abetting illegal discrimination. While discrimination is illegal, critics have already raised significant concerns that this language could be used to target organizations with diversity, equity, and inclusion, or DEI, programs that the current administration opposes.
So using it to target specific types of programs.
Effectively turning a program designed to foster public good into a political weapon. Lastly, and more conventionally, it addresses supporting foreign terrorist organizations, though this category too is broadly defined and could be subject to expansive interpretation.
Okay, so the definitions are key, but what about the process for deciding this?
Yeah, beyond the definitions themselves, the procedural mechanisms outlined in this proposed rule are just as significant, if not more so, for their potential impact. The proposal would grant the Secretary of Education the unilateral authority to determine an employer's ineligibility based on a preponderance of the evidence.
Preponderance of the evidence. That's a lower standard than in criminal court, right?
Much lower. It essentially means more likely than not. And it crucially does not require a formal court conviction or judgment of illegality. So the secretary could make this determination based on agency findings alone. And even more critically, the rule would explicitly prohibit borrowers, the public servants themselves, from requesting reconsideration of the secretary's determination.
No appeal. Seriously.
Effectively removes their right to an administrative appeal, leaving them with potentially no recourse but costly and time-consuming litigation. If an employer is deemed ineligible, they would be barred from the PSLF program for 10 years unless they complete a corrective action plan approved solely by the secretary. Think about that. A decade-long ban, with the future of millions of dollars in loan forgiveness resting on an administrative determination with no appeal process.
That's huge power for the secretary, and the potential impact, even if they say it's only a few organizations.
Right. The potential impact of this rule, despite the Department of Education projecting what appears to be a modest $1.537 billion in savings over 10 years, and estimating fewer than 10 organizations would be disqualified annually, is far more substantial than those numbers suggest. The department itself acknowledges in its own analysis that the impact would be concentrated in vital sectors like healthcare, education, and social services.
Where PSLF is crucial for recruitment and retention.
Exactly. Advocacy groups have reacted with immediate alarm, anticipating a wide-ranging chilling effect. Kristen McGuire, CEO of Young Invincibles, a group focused on young people's economic well-being, didn't mince words, calling the proposal a political stunt that exploits the student loan system to attack political opponents. Similarly, the National Council of Nonprofits warned that the rule could easily serve as a pretext for the administration to punish nonprofits for providing services and support that are politically unpopular with the party in power, rather than genuinely addressing illegal conduct.
And didn't this come out of a negotiated rulemaking process?
It did, and the contentious nature of the proposal was evident even in that process, which is designed to build consensus among stakeholders. That process concluded in July without reaching the required consensus, specifically because the negotiator representing civil rights and consumer protection organizations dissented, clearly seeing the politicized nature of the definitions.
So no consensus going in. Okay, if we pull all of this together, what's the core takeaway here? What does this proposed rule truly signify for the idea of public service in America?
Well, this proposed rule represents a stark and concerning example of using the administrative state's powerful regulatory levers to pursue a distinct ideological agenda, subtly reshaping the legal landscape without legislative action. The facially neutral goal of ensuring program integrity is, in effect, undermined by the highly targeted, politically charged definitions of illegal purpose and the concentration of discretionary enforcement power in a single political appointee.
It really shifts the definition of public service itself.
Absolutely. Away from the nature of an individual's work, whether it's teaching, nursing, social work, or legal aid, and toward the ideological alignment of their employer. The rule represents a profound politicization of a major federal benefits program. It transforms the administrative process into a potential tool for penalizing organizations whose missions conflict with the administration's political platform, creating a chilling effect on their activities and jeopardizing the financial planning of millions of dedicated public servants who depend on PSLF for their economic stability.
So it injects political litmus tests into a program designed to encourage civic contribution, raising serious questions about the future of nonpartisan public service.
Exactly. A really fundamental shift being proposed there. Okay, now shifting gears completely, but sticking with August 18th and executive action in a completely different domain, but equally significant for its long-term implications for U.S. military strategy and alliances, also published in the Federal Register on August 18th, was a key record of decision, or ROD, from the Department of the Air Force concerning Anderson Air Force Base in Guam.
Ah, yes, the Guam decision. This seemingly bureaucratic document holds profound strategic weight.
It really does.
This document contained a dual decision of significant strategic importance for the Indo-Pacific. On one hand, it formally canceled a long-planned initiative to permanently base a squadron of F-15 fighter jets from the Republic of Singapore Air Force, or RSAF, on the island. This was a notable reversal of a multi-year effort. But simultaneously, and this is crucial, it emphatically reaffirmed the commitment to proceed with a massive, multi-year infrastructure upgrade at that very same base.
So, cancel the planes, but build the facilities anyway.
Pretty much. This decision, while seemingly a minor logistical adjustment on the surface, is in fact a clear and tangible manifestation of a fundamental evolving shift in U.S. military strategy for the Indo-Pacific region, adapting to a new era of great power competition.
Let's unpack that. The original plan, formalized back in a 2019 Memorandum of Understanding, was a classic overseas basing agreement. It called for the permanent bed down, that's the term for permanent stationing, of up to 12 RSAF F-15SG fighters and their associated personnel at Anderson Air Force Base by 2029.
Right. Standard procedure for allies needing training space.
Exactly. The idea was to provide Singapore, a close partner, with much-needed airspace for advanced pilot training, which is limited in their small country. The official rationale for the cancellation cited by the Air Force was a mutual agreement between the United States and Singapore, specifically mentioning a review of RSAF training requirements and findings from an environmental impact statement.
Okay, plausible deniability, perhaps?
Perhaps. Singapore's Ministry of Defense publicly confirmed that they would continue to use Guam for periodic, short-term training deployments, implying a continuation of ties, but without the permanent presence. So on the surface, it sounds like a perfectly reasonable, mutual, logistical adjustment between allies.
However, the more strategically significant part of the decision, and what immediately caught the attention of defense analysts and strategists, was the unwavering commitment to continue with the vast, indeed monumental, infrastructure construction on Anderson's North Ramp. This project is not a small undertaking. It's one of the largest military construction efforts currently underway anywhere in the Pacific theater.
Billions of dollars, right?
Billions. It includes the development of 192 acres of new airfield pavements. Essentially massive new runways and taxiways, along with hangars, maintenance facilities, and advanced fuel systems designed to support rapid, large-scale aircraft operations. Crucially, the planning documents explicitly state that this new infrastructure is intended to be multi-purpose.
Ah, multi-purpose. Key phrase.
Very key. It's designed not just to support the now-canceled Singaporean mission, but a wide array of other DF, service component, and partner nation aircraft or missions operating from Anderson AFB now or in the future. This detail is key. It's about flexibility for the future.
And this ties directly into modern U.S. military doctrine for the Indo-Pacific, specifically a concept known as Agile Combat Employment. Or ACE.
ACE, yeah, we hear that a lot now.
This doctrine recognizes a fundamental vulnerability that has become increasingly apparent in recent years. Large, concentrated, and predictable U.S. bases like Anderson are highly susceptible to attack from an adversary like China, which possesses a sophisticated and growing arsenal of long-range precision missiles.
Big bases are big targets.
Exactly. The strategic response to this threat is to disperse U.S. forces across a wider and more resilient network of locations, allowing them to operate in a more unpredictable and flexible manner, making them harder targets and more survivable in a conflict.
Precisely. This decision regarding the Guam F-15s is the physical embodiment, the concrete manifestation of the strategic shift from what military planners call a bases model to a places model.
Bases versus places. Explain that.
Instead of creating a permanent fixed home for a specific allied unit, which would be a predictable and therefore vulnerable base, The U.S. is investing billions to enhance Anderson's capacity to serve as a hardened, versatile strategic hub, a crucial place from which a dynamic and unpredictable rotation of various U.S. and allied forces can surge, operate, and then rapidly disperse.
So build the infrastructure, keep it flexible, don't lock it down to one user.
This is the idea. By canceling the permanent Singaporean deployment while simultaneously building the extensive infrastructure that could host them or any other partner on a temporary rotational basis, the Air Force is clearly prioritizing strategic flexibility and resilience over a fixed static presence. It implies a capability to project power rapidly and flexibly without presenting a static bullseye.
So this is not a diplomatic failure or a simple administrative change.
No, it's much bigger than that.
It is a clear indicator of U.S. military strategy in action, actively adapting its posture in the Pacific to be more survivable and effective in a potential high-end conflict scenario, acknowledging the evolving nature of warfare in the region.
A really significant strategic signal embedded in a seemingly routine decision.
Now, beyond the high-profile diplomatic maneuvers and the transformative regulatory proposals that dominated the headlines and shaped our first two segments, it's crucial to remember that the period of August 16th to 18th, 2025, also showcased the ceaseless, methodical functioning of the U.S. federal government. This ongoing, often unseen activity provides a critical context, demonstrating the sheer resilience and vastness of governmental processes, quietly humming along even when the political spotlight is elsewhere.
Absolutely. A detailed examination of the administrative record during this intense 72-hour period reveals the vast machinery of the state continuing its essential, often technical work, largely insulated from the political storms of the moment. The Monday, August 18th edition of the Federal Register, for instance, serves as a comprehensive ledger of the administrative state's daily operations.
The government's daily diary, essentially.
Pretty much. This particular volume contained an impressive 87 separate documents originating from 40 different federal agencies, spanning the full spectrum of governmental responsibilities. This highlights that these actions, while lacking the political drama of a presidential summit or controversial new rule, are truly the bedrock of effective governance, the unglamorous but vital functions that impact daily life.
And a significant portion of the day's activity was dedicated to core safety and regulatory functions that impact us all every single day, often without us even realizing it. The Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, for example, published multiple final rules issuing airworthiness directives for various models of Airbus helicopters and airplanes.
Keeping planes safe. That's pretty important.
Very important. These are highly technical documents that mandate specific inspections or modifications to address identified safety issues, ensuring that the aircraft flying overhead are safe. These are critical routine components for ensuring public safety in the skies, a constant vigilance that never stops, regardless of the political calendar.
And economic and trade policy also saw continued methodical work demonstrating the long-term nature of these efforts. The Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, or USTR, issued public notices related to its annual review of notorious markets for counterfeiting and piracy, a crucial tool in protecting American intellectual property globally.
Fighting fakes, basically.
Right. They also announced public hearings on China's compliance with its World Trade Organization commitments, reflecting an ongoing and foundational aspect of U.S. trade enforcement and policy towards a major economic competitor. Simultaneously, the Treasury Department published a notice seeking information on innovative methods to detect illicit financial activity involving digital assets.
Trying to keep up with crypto crime.
Exactly. This proactive engagement with emerging economic challenges, like cryptocurrency fraud or money laundering, demonstrates the continuous adaptation of government functions to new realities. These aren't reactive measures to weekend headlines. They're the steady, persistent work of maintaining global economic integrity.
And the sheer breadth of routine governance continued with a host of other agency actions that paint a fascinating picture of the federal government's diverse responsibilities. The Department of Justice's Antitrust Division, for example, published a series of notices under the National Cooperative Research and Production Act. These aren't about breaking up monopolies, but processing filings for a surprisingly diverse range of industry consortia.
What?
From the American Massage Therapy Association. Yes, you heard that right. To the REST Foundation, a group supporting the development of a modern programming language.
Okay, the American Massage Therapy Association needed an antitrust notice. That's specific.
It's almost comically routine, isn't it? While the world seemed to be shifting on its axis somewhere, a civil servant was still processing applications for the American Massage Therapy Association. Elsewhere in the register, agencies carried out their legally mandated duties. The Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, or CMS, and the Department of Defense, or DOD, filed standard requests for the collection of information, a mundane but essential administrative function.
Paperwork. Lots of paperwork.
Lots of it. The Civil Rights Commission and the National Institutes of Health, NIH, announced upcoming public meetings, ensuring transparency and public engagement continue. And the National Park Service documented the completion of inventories under the Native American Graves Protection and Repatriation Act, a solemn and ongoing responsibility to honor Indigenous heritage.
This detailed record of administrative action provides a vital counterpoint to the high-profile political events of the weekend. It demonstrates unmistakably that the U.S. government is not a monolith directed solely by the president's immediate priorities or the news cycle.
Right. It's a huge ecosystem.
Exactly. Rather, it is a complex, decentralized ecosystem of agencies and dedicated civil servants diligently executing legally mandated functions, many of which are nonpartisan and essential for public well-being. While the political leadership was engaged in dramatic policy shifts and high-stakes diplomatic maneuvers, the day-to-day work of implementing existing laws, ensuring aircraft are safe, enforcing trade agreements, managing healthcare programs, and processing routine applications continued unabated. This illustrates the significant inertia and continuity inherent in the federal bureaucracy, which ensures the persistence of core governmental functions, even amidst periods of intense political upheaval and partisan strife. It's the constant underlying hum of governance that enables the more visible, dramatic actions.
The gears keep turning no matter what.
Pretty much.
And it's important to underscore that the assertive and wide-ranging actions of the executive branch during the 72-hour period were, in large part, made possible, or at least significantly facilitated, by the concurrent inactivity of the other two branches of the federal government. Both Congress and the Supreme Court were deep in their traditional August recess, creating a temporary but significant policy-making vacuum that the White House was able to fill decisively.
Looking at the legislative branch, the 119th Congress was definitively not in session for any substantive legislative business between August 16th and August 18th. Both the House of Representatives and the Senate met only for brief, constitutionally required pro forma sessions.
Pro forma. So basically just gaveling in and out.
Exactly. Think of these pro forma sessions as the absolute bare minimum, a procedural nod to the Constitution, perhaps a single member tapping the gavel, marking attendance, and then immediately adjourning. There was no substantive debate, no legislative proposals introduced, and certainly no votes taken. The next scheduled day for actual legislative business for both chambers was Tuesday, August 19th.
So complete legislative dormancy during this key period.
Right. This legislative dormancy is a critical piece of context for the events of the weekend. With no ability to hold immediate hearings, introduce legislation to counter executive actions, or otherwise provide an active, immediate check on executive power, Congress effectively ceded the entire policymaking stage to the president. This allowed the administration to unilaterally drive the narrative on the Russo-Ukrainian war and initiate major regulatory changes without immediate legislative pushback or oversight, at least for this crucial window.
And the courts.
Similarly, the judicial branch was largely dormant, observing its traditional summer respite. The Supreme Court was in the midst of its annual summer recess, that usual period between the end of one term in late June or early July and the beginning of the next in October.
So no big rulings expected.
None at all. On Monday, August 18th, the court did follow its standard procedure by releasing a scheduled summer order list. As is typical for these purely administrative lists, it consisted solely of routine orders. There were no grants of certiorari for new cases to be heard in the upcoming term, no new opinions, and no major rulings. While the specific PDF of the order list wasn't immediately accessible to the public, court observers and historical practice confirmed the non-merits, purely administrative nature of this action.
Just keeping the lights on, administratively speaking.
That's a good way to put it. So in essence, there were no new rulings, no significant legal developments, and certainly no judicial interventions emanating from the nation's highest court during this period that might have complicated or challenged the executive's moves.
Okay, so this combined congressional and judicial quietude created a unique environment.
It absolutely did. It allowed the executive branch to act as the sole active and agenda-setting institution of the federal government, operating with an almost unmatched scope of influence and uninhibited by the usual checks and balances that are typically present when all three branches are fully engaged. It was a strategic window of opportunity, and the administration clearly seized it.
A perfect storm for executive action, maybe.
You could say that. Hashtag tag outro.
This intense 72-hour period from August 16th to August 18th, 2025, truly stands as a vivid case study in the exercise of executive power. While the U.S. Congress and Supreme Court were in recess, the White House and its administrative agencies moved with remarkable speed, precision, and deliberation to enact a consequential and ideologically distinct agenda.
Yeah, it was quite a weekend.
It was a brief but intensely active window defined by a powerful assertion of presidential authority on both the international and domestic fronts, fundamentally altering the trajectory of major U.S. policies.
Indeed. We saw two primary thrusts. Internationally, the administration executed a rapid and sophisticated pivot following the Alaska summit. It successfully reframed a diplomatic meeting that notably failed to achieve its stated objective, an immediate ceasefire, as a strategic choice to pursue a more ambitious peace agreement.
A masterful spin, some might say.
This new framework, articulated through a highly coordinated media campaign, adopted key Russian talking points and squarely shifted diplomatic pressure onto Ukraine to make significant concessions. The result was a strained transatlantic alliance and a deeply precarious new reality for Kyiv.
And domestically.
Domestically, the administration leveraged the regulatory process to advance a transformative agenda, including the proposed overhaul of the Public Service Loan Forgiveness Program, which effectively politicizes a major federal benefits program by tying eligibility to ideological alignment. Concurrently, the decision regarding the F-15 deployment in Guam served as a concrete example of a major strategic shift in U.S. military posture in the Indo-Pacific, moving towards a more agile and resilient force structure.
And all of these high-stakes, high-profile actions occurred against a fascinating backdrop of the steady, methodical work of the broader administrative state, which continued its core functions of safety regulation, trade enforcement, and routine governance, demonstrating the institutional resilience and continuous operation of the federal bureaucracy.
The contrast is really striking.
It is. These events, occurring over such a short span, have truly established the immediate agenda for the coming weeks, setting the stage for crucial follow-on developments. The most critical near-term event, of course, is the scheduled August 18th meeting in Washington between President Trump, President Zelensky, and key European leaders. This high-stakes summit will be the first direct test of the new diplomatic landscape.
A huge meeting.
Revealing whether the U.S. will succeed in pressuring Ukraine toward concessions or if a unified Ukrainian-European front can effectively create a new path forward.
And in the domestic sphere, the publication of that controversial PSLF rule has initiated a 30-day public comment period. This period will undoubtedly become the opening salvo in what is likely to be a protracted legal and political battle over the future of public service and the proper use or potential overreach of administrative power.
Yeah, that fight is just beginning.
So, considering this intense 72-hour snapshot, a period where one branch of the U.S. federal government operated at maximal capacity while the others were largely dormant, what stands out to you most about the delicate balance of power within the American system? How might such strategic leveraging of institutional quietude ultimately shape future policy debates and even redefine the very notion of public service in the years to come?
That's a powerful question to consider, a crucial one for understanding where we're headed. Thank you for joining us on the Deep Dive. We encourage you to continue exploring these complex and vital issues as they unfold.